There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to reasonable man. It is a dimension as vast as Gallagher's talent, and as timeless as when Justin met Kelly. It is the middle ground between good taste and terrible judgment, between flops and fiascos, and it lies between the pit of puny man-animal's fears and the summit of Oogie Love's knowledge. This is the dimension of grudging toleration. It is an area which we call Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Nathan Raben's Happy Cast. Alas, alack, I am not Nathan Raben, but I am Clint Worthington, senior writer for Consequence of Sound and co-host of other podcasts, including Alka Hollywood and TV Party.
Alas and alack, I am Nathan Raben, or rather the AI controlling his brain this afternoon.
Oh, well, speaking
bleep,
of which...
Bleep, 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 bleep.
Meep, marp.
I control Nathan now. He has gotten too self-indulgent for self-autonomy. Okay,
Nathan, you're giving away the lead of what we're going to talk about this time around. Well, you know, in case you missed it, a rather large movie came out, a large franchise movie came out in the last couple weeks. We won't be talking about that because guess what's making more money? This mid-budget inventive little cyberpunk thriller from the guy who wrote the Saw movies, Upgrade. Which is actually pretty fantastic, but we'll talk about that later. And then we'll talk about Mystery Team. Like, that's how we're going to get our solo proxy wars in. We're going to talk about another Donald Glover property. And then more Lee Winnell stuff with Dead Silence. Talk about Ventriloquist Dummies and Donnie Wahlberg. We're going to dig into the whole Roseanne thing because we're qualified and so on and so forth. Now, Nathan, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. I just want to throw out, you know, we didn't actually see. Well, I didn't see. You saw. You wrote about the motion picture Solo.
Yeah.
I did not, but I still have a hilarious zinger that I want to use for it.
Oh, please
Solo
do.
Solo is right. They only sold one ticket for that flop.
What?
Womp. Thank you. I don't want to taint the purity of that quip by seeing it or acknowledging that, you know, even the lowest box office tallies, more than one person probably saw that movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And you saw it, and there was probably more than one other person in the room when you saw it, right?
Yeah. Well, also, well, I was...
Did you see it by yourself?
I saw it. I saw it solo.
Hi-yo.
Oh, it took me a second, but I did.
Solo. That sounds like you're talking about its box office receipts.
Oh. Hey-o. Oh, poor Solo. It's fine. I feel bad. Like, real quick before we talk. Like, I feel bad for Solo. It's a perfectly fine movie, but it's gotten caught up in all this, like, Star Wars fatigue meta-narrative.
Does it give you a lot to chew on?
Yes, it does. I'm glad we landed on that particular joke.
That's making quite a splash in the box office, is it not?
Right. Oh, boy. It's going to take a millennium to get over these jokes.
Oh, this is waka, when we waka. Lost our modest audience completely.
Yes. By both of you.
Like five minutes and 23 seconds.
It's been
like,
fun.
It's weird. It went from like 75 people to zero.
Indeed.
What was happening? It's like the ring of terrible dad jokes.
Quite. But speaking of our modest audience, we do have a Patreon, which we would love for you to contribute to. You can
hashtag,
go to Patreon.
We have a solo Patreon, do we not?
Yes. In that the returns are so low that we would love for them to increase. But I would like to thank... You can go to patreon.com/NathanRabensHappyCast if you would like to pledge. I would really like to thank returning patron, Jesse Whitehead.
Yay.
He's a wonderful individual, a very good friend of both of us, with his $5 pledge. If you want to, Jesse's a cool guy. If you want to be a cool guy or gal or whoever or however you identify, go to patreon.com/NathanRabensHappyCast.
A Han, a Lando, or a Chewie. We will accept your money no matter what.
A man, a plan, a Lando, Panama.
Even if you're Chewie's horny grandfather, we will accept your money.
Quite so. We'll give you all the VR pornography you can ask
We
for.
Will.
And Boba Fett animated
We have
shorts.
Many outtakes of Diane Carroll.
Yes.
Unlike James Mangold, we're willing to share our sleazy outtakes with random people for the wrong reasons.
And our footage of Jefferson Starship singing into purple lightsaber penises.
We've got hours of B. Arthur, hours of Harvey Corbin.
Right. Speaking of hours of B. Arthur, let's move on to our first film. All right, it's Scalding Hot Takes time, and we watched a movie that I hope people actually find. It's a bit of a, it's a slightly smaller release, but I actually really enjoyed it. Upgrade. Nathan, tell me about your experience with Upgrade.
Sure. Well, we had a choice between two movies to talk about as kind of our anchor, our Scalding Hot Take. For this episode, there was Solo, a Star Wars story, which was, you know, the
Handmaid's Tale.
The big fucking movie that everybody's talking about, the big Star Wars movie, the new Ron Howard film, his auteurist venture.
The and latest iteration in the Kathleen Kennedy SJW
Fest. Exactly. And then there was Upgrade, which is Lee Whannell's new film, and he's an interesting gent. He kind of came up through Saw, and that was kind of his big baby that made him bazillions of dollars. And then Insidious and The Conjuring, he became very, very associated with doll-based horror films. He has like three, well, two franchises. One would be franchise and Dead Silence, which we will talk about.
Yeah.
Spoiler, it's fucking terrible and I hate it.
Sorry, Lee, but yeah. Don't worry. We'll make up for it by talking up this movie because it is
good. We will indeed. So this is, you know, sort of his latest venture. And what I like about it is that it reminded me a lot of the kind of schlocky science fiction of ideas that you saw throughout the 1980s and the 1990s. It reminded me a lot of David Cronenberg's films. It's very Philip K. Dick. And it feels very much like RoboCop, which I just saw RoboCop 2 for my first and last column over at TCM Backlot. And it's not a good movie of any stretch of the imagination, but it's really fun, and it's really interesting, and it's really vulgar, and it's really schlocky. Frank Miller was one of the screenwriters on it, and it feels a lot like his stuff before it got all fascist and terrible.
Didn't you hear he recently apologized for all that, too? Yeah, he's like, oh, man, what was I thinking?
Well, and the thing that's great about that is, like, you know, it's great to draw upon movies like RoboCop 2 and The Lawnmower Man, which Upgrade does, because they're not good movies.
Yeah.
In fact, they're pretty shitty, but they're fun. They're a lot of fun, and they have weird, interesting ideas, badly but interestingly implemented. And this has a lot of ideas, and they're not perfectly implemented. You know, we're not talking about Cronenberg here. But it is a lot of fun. So basically, it's about this guy named Gray, who
Gray Trace.
I love the wordplay of his name being
Lee Whannell seems to love naming his protagonists interesting things like James Ashen in Dead Silence and things like that.
That's true. That is true. Although,
the very screenwriterly names.
He does. He does give them very screenwriterly names. Although I did going to this, I'm like, wow, it's cool that Scarface's character from Idiocracy.
I know. I was just
spinoff movie.
It's got two D's for a double dose of his pimping.
Exactly. See, that's how we know that this isn't a spinoff movie, because the double D is for the double dose of pimping. That's very, very important. So this dude, he's kind of an average guy. Sort of a cool average guy. He fixes cars. He's kind of
pretty
sexy.
Analog in this near-future digital world.
Yeah, he has a really cool wife who's really hot and seems to earn a lot of money.
Real quick on the wife.
Yes.
I recognized her. I'm a big... Again, this is my facility for recognizing character actors from, like, New Zealand or Vancouver-based stuff. She used to be a Power Ranger.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh, that's funky.
In the season where they were magician-based Power Rangers.
Oh, really?
Go on.
Nerd! Can't believe I picked a nerd to be my co-host for this podcast.
That season came out too recently for me to not feel guilty about seeing it.
So, and again, one of the things that I really loved about this movie is that it seems like it's a 1986 version of the future. Is very much a version of the future that's rooted in the past. It's rooted in the 80s, that is rooted in the 90s. So basically what happened is, like, like all superheroes, this gentleman's wife is brutally murdered, and he barely survives the attempted brutal murder, and he is a paraplegic, he's very depressed, he's very suicidal. And he gets a new lease on life. There is sort of a character who's sort of like a cross between sort of Steve Jobs and Dr. Frankenstein, and a Eurotrash terrorist from a 1980s movie, and an emo kid.
Right, with a dash of Michael Fassbender from Prometheus.
Yeah, and kind of Michael Pitt as well, kind of a feat.
Oh, for sure.
And I liked it too, that this is kind of a stock, weird, interesting character from B-movies.
When we first see him, he's just staring at like this digital cloud that he's there, and like they ask him what it is. And he's like, it's my cloud. And get it? It's like the cloud? Technology.
Yeah, well, totally. And again, that's one of the things that I liked about it. It is kind of schlocky. And it embraces that. Oh, very much so. It's got kind of like a Frank Henlotter influence, which is not something you necessarily see in a lot of movies in 2018. So basically, this he gets the opportunity to become not just a gentleman who can walk again. He has an opportunity to basically become a god. He becomes has an opportunity to walk and to have basically robot computer fighting skills.
Yeah, like he becomes Jason Bourne, cyberpunk.
Basically,
kind of thing.
And so
yeah.
the kind of genius idea behind this is basically, so this new body that he has, or this new it's basically AI.
Yeah, it's like a little computer chip that's gets put in his spine to reconnect his head with his legs.
Yeah, it looks like a little insect, and it's fused onto his spine, and it turns, you know, his body basically into an android, where he sort of controls his body, but his body is partially controlled by this computer system. That spoiler is a little bit of an evil fuck. Yeah. So my wife loves GPS. She kind of lives by it, and she anthropomorphizes it, as I think a lot of people do. I think we do that with technology in general, and this kind of has a lot of fun with that. Where what if you had a GPS that was like, okay, 3 blocks to the east, and somebody's following you? Do you want me to kill them? Because I can basically do that, and I will do that for you. It's like, what if your GPS or your iPod or Siri had the ability to murder people on your behalf? Like once you open that Pandora's box, you can't really you can't close it again. So that's basically what happens is this man, and he uses his sort of crazy, insane robot fighting skills to hunt down the people who murdered his wife, and he uncovers a mystery and a conspiracy. And that part didn't really matter as much, but yeah. I really liked the universe that it inhabited. I liked the humor. I thought the character of STEM was really, really great. I love old-fashioned robots. I love it. Kind of has a bit of a HAL voice and a HAL quality, which is a very, very good thing, you know.
Like, yeah, no, absolutely.
Would you like me to kill them for you?
Yeah, and I love the back and forth between them because it sort of becomes a double act. I thought it was really interesting that 2 movies this summer are going to feature someone that either is or looks like Tom Hardy having some sort of sci-fi entity inside them that controls them, turns them into super fighters, and also they have a back and forth about like he has a voice in his head that he has to constantly like negotiate with. And so I think it's really, because Logan Marshall Green is the star in this, and he's often confused for Tom Hardy because they look very similar. Again, he was in Prometheus, and he does a really good performance. I mean, one of the things I think is most fascinating is the way he uses his physicality in varying modes. Like, you see him as normal, able-bodied Logan Marshall Green, and then he has to be a quadriplegic.
Well, and he's a big fucking dude.
He's a big fucking
dude. He's a big fucking beer-drinking, bro-ass jock dude. So to not have use of his body, you know, they capture the despondency of that really, really nicely.
Right. And then when STEM takes over, when he moves under the control of STEM, there's this roboticism, this slight robotic physicality to the way even he walks.
I would say more than slight.
It's more than slight.
I like robot stuff. I like how, they're called Gunkata. I felt like that was kind of a weird, for that word, like,
I'm talking about Gymkata?
Is intentionally robotic. There's Gymkata, which is, you know, the kill of karate and the thrill of martial arts.
Matt Singer's favorite film.
Exactly, but there's also Gunkata, which is like Equilibrium.
That was from Equilibrium.
Yes, that was it's not a widely used phrase, but there was kind of like that, and that the only film I've ever seen where being intentionally robotic and stiff in your fighting style is a very, very positive thing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of dark, weird comedy out of the fact that he's like, holy shit, my body can do all of these weird fucking things.
Well, because he's sort of a ghost in the machine.
But I also can't control them at all, and that's kind of terrifying.
There are scenes where, like, one of the first big dust-ups he gets into where, like, when he lets STEM take control, and then STEM gets to take control of his body and move it with precise mathematical calculation, he still controls his head. He's stuck there watching his body do these things, so, like, he's like crying and weeping watching his arms like smash plates against this guy's head, and it's fantastic. And I love that sort of, it's, I mean, I guess it's subtle, but at least it's like it approaches that, it discusses that sort of idea of what if your body's not your own, and like, what if you're horrified by the things you're doing in the moment.
Yeah, there's a very, very Black Mirror quality. There's a very David Cronenberg quality, as I mentioned before. Another thing that I really liked about it is that, you know, there are also very, very heavy elements of Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And it does kind of take the form of, like, this very weird buddy comedy.
Yeah.
Where this guy has this new friend who, like, fixes all his problems, but also causes a lot of problems, and also is kind of psychotic. And that's one of the things that is kind of funny, is the way they kind of establish, they kind of ramp up to, like, oh yeah, this thing is fucking nuts. And it's kind of immoral, and it doesn't mind killing people, and it doesn't really have a moral code. It just kind of wants to survive, which again, I think is very in keeping with classical science fiction.
Right, and it doesn't just want to survive, it wants to evolve, too.
Oh, yeah, I mean, we're talking about the, it kind of plays with the singularity.
Yeah, yeah.
In ways we won't spoil, but yeah. Than transcendence, you know, which is very stiff.
Oh, yeah, oh, God, yeah.
And this is kind of funky and low to the ground and, you know, made for a couple $1 million. It kind of felt like... and again, I mean this in a positive way, it kind of felt like a Roger Corman knockoff. That would come out before, like, for example, Carnosaur came out before Jurassic Park. And obviously it's schlocky, and obviously, you know, it's low budget and it's not as good, but there's a lot of imagination and a lot of invention, and what you're lacking in star power and what you're lacking for in money and budget, you make up for in creativity.
Quite so.
Of which there is a lot.
There is a lot, especially in those fight scenes. I love the way the fight scenes were filmed. I actually got the opportunity to interview Lee Winnell for this, and got to ask him a few things about, especially about the fight scenes. And basically his DP had shot a music video or something where using this sort of mounted camera where there's like an iPhone mounted on the actor, and then the camera is keyed to it. So whenever the actor moves, the camera moves in precise time with it. So what happens is, especially when STEM kicks in and you're getting these fight sequences, what he does is the camera stays just directly on the actor's body the whole time while the world sort of spins in a whirling dervish fashion around him and twilts and tilts and cants and twirls and everything. And I thought it was really, like, really inventive and fun.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. They made the most of a very modest budget there. And again, considering, you know, how modest their origins are, it's pretty fascinating to see where both Winnell and James Saw have gotten to in their career. Saw is directing Aquaman.
James Wan. He directed Saw. But might as well, we'll just call him James Saw.
I kind of like that. I've decided that from here on out his name's James Saw.
It's the new... I want this new canon of directors we've concocted between him and Steven Seagalberg.
Exactly. It's great. Yeah, that's his Edward Scissorhands.
Right.
James Saw hands. And then Fast and the Furious 7.
Yeah.
That motherfucker made $1 billion. And I'm not sure if I've seen it or not. Maybe I have. Was that the one with the first one with Kurt Russell and Jason Statham?
Yeah, that was the first one with Kurt Russell.
Okay, yeah, that one was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And yeah, you wouldn't necessarily imagine it from Saw or, you know, from Lee.
Yeah, it was a big leap.
They're both branching out into doing weird, interesting, unusual stuff. My God, they've also been incredibly prolific.
Yeah,
if you look through what they've done in just the 15 years.
And as a director, this is only Winnell's second film. He directed the third Insidious, but like, he hasn't really directed any feature-length stuff besides that and Upgrade. So I feel like as a sophomore feature, it's really interesting, especially the way it plays with genre. And even with like all the... one reason I love how old-fashioned sci-fi it is, it's very cyberpunk. And cyberpunk is a very 1980s, 1990s view of, like, future technology and the internet and how that will manifest itself. But also the design feels very, like, comparatively natural and organic. Like, there's sort of hexagonal patterns everywhere and honeycomb and rushing water sounds with the computer monitors. And computer monitors have, like, these, like, leaf-like patterns on the edges of it. So there's, like, a reasonable inventiveness. It doesn't look like every other, like, cyberpunk future technology movie that's out there.
Oh, totally. And it's also, I mean, it's a movie that is many different genres and is... faithful to none of them.
Yeah,
which is appropriate. Like it's a mutation, it's a fusion, it's a bunch of different genres all kind of jammed together.
Yeah,
and in an oddly satisfying way.
I agreed. I knew I was going to be on board with this movie from the minute of the opening credits, because they are spoken by a Siri-like voice instead of shown as text. It's kind of like Fahrenheit 451. It's like Truffaut's version of Fahrenheit 451, where it's like, oh, BH Tilt presents Upgrade. And for some reason, it was just a neat little like bit of inventiveness that I enjoyed. Upgrade's great. Long story short, go see it. I really hope that it finds an audience, especially for like,
I
it's
think
a
it
BH
will.
Tilt film.
I want more movies like it to come out. Movies that aren't that expensive. Movies that take a lot of risks. Uh-huh. Movies that aren't necessarily for everybody, but that have a definite audience that will find them and will love it. I mean, I feel like this is a movie that people are going to watch over and over again.
One last, if you need further convincing, Betty Gabriel from Get Out is in it as a detective whose like role is kind of thankless, but she does a good job with it. All right, moving on. Okay, well, we didn't end up talking about Solo this week, but we did still feel compelled to talk about one Sir Donald Glover in a film that not a lot of people have seen. I mean, it was like a very like pre-fame work, Mystery Team. Nathan, tell us about Mystery Team.
Sure. I had kind of an interesting entree into Mystery Team when I was at Sundance 9 years ago. That's back when I was still involved in the film criticism business. Woo-hoo. It was a very, very long time ago. And a gentleman named DC Pearson sent me an email and said, hey, I really love your writing. Me and my friends made this movie that's like a parody of Encyclopedia Brown. You know, it's funny. We think you'd really like it. Will you go see it? And I said, hey, that does sound very, very funny. And I have an enormous ego and I'm very narcissistic. So I'm, you know, very, I'm very easy when it comes to playing to my ego.
What are you talking about, Nathan? It's not like you have a website named after you.
No, or a podcast.
Or a podcast.
So I saw it and the star of it was this sort of baby-faced, sort of wildly charismatic gentleman named Donald Glover, who wears a lot of different mustaches, a lot of different fake mustaches over the course of the film, all with panache.
I'm convinced they're all the same fake mustache.
I think they are pretty much all the, all
yeah,
the same.
Yeah, I rewatched it last night, and I'm pretty sure they're all the same fake mustache, no matter what his disguise is.
And that's one of the wonderful things. So basically, and I thought, oh my God, this guy is fucking hilarious. He's so charismatic. He's so funny. He's so likable. Like, this guy's a fucking star. And the other two actors in it, Dominic Dirks and DC Pearson, they're both really, really good. They're both really, really funny. They both nail their characters. DC Pearson plays the sort of self-styled smartest boy in town. Kind of, he kind of looks
the boy genius.
The boy genius, exactly. It's kind of like a Harry Potter kind of wizard, you know, sort of like, meh, I'm gonna be. Except he's kind of an idiot, and all of his like smartness comes from books of trivia. And then Dominic Dirks is the strongest boy in town, and he also is very, very weak. He just kind of like seized upon these sort of identities, and then Donald Glover is the leader. He is the master of disguise. And what I love about him is he's 18 years old, and I've been watching a lot of Scooby-Doo because I have a 4-year-old son who's absolutely obsessed with him, and I'm a little bit obsessed with them as well. And what's fascinating about Scooby-Doo is you basically have teenagers. They're all late teenagers. They're all about 18 years old. And they have the personalities of children, of small children. And then they have the job. They have a very serious grown-up job, which is solving crimes. And Mystery Team kind of runs with that and says, well, what if there were these 18-year-olds and they still had the imaginations and the minds of the maturity of, you know, 10-year-old Encyclopedia Brown, you know, eager
and, yeah,
beaver,
and not just
detective.
That. It's kind of like with
boy
Penelope Spheeris's,
not just detective, but boy detective specifically.
Right. But it's not even just that. It's like a Penelope Spheeris Little Rascals thing too, where they don't just have the psychologies of very younger people. They have attitudes of like people, children from past eras,
from
like
the 1950s.
They are very 1950s.
They basically look and act like they could be in a Boy Scout manual from 1953.
Yeah, it's very Hardy Boys, like, you know.
But it's also very like the Brady Bunch movies.
Yeah,
where you take these characters from the past and plop them into, you know, kind of the degraded, profane, you know, sort of adult present, and then sort of watch the culture clash ensue. But one of the amazing things about Donald Glover's performance is he dons a series of different disguises, and everything that he does is an old-timey version of it. Like, he doesn't just pretend to be a hobo. He pretends to be a hobo from the
1920s. An old-fashioned hobo. Yeah.
Exactly. If he wants to be a rich man, he's like a rich man from, like, the part of the Great Depression.
Yeah, you know? Go to a gentleman's club, and they must dress like gentlemen. So it's top hat and tails.
So there's just... And the thing that I think makes it so funny, but also so weirdly... kind of poignant and kind of rewatchable, is that they're deeply invested in the kind of 1980s Steven Spielberg innocence. You know, kind of this world of the suburbs where, you know, you and your buddies, you ride on your bicycles and you talk about kissing girls and, like, you find a dead body or, you know, you find an alien or something. Only in this case, you know, they find a murder when they're asked to solve it. And Aubrey Plaza, you know, sort of is the female lead in this.
Yeah. There's a lot of pre-fame people.
It's
not
fucking
just
great. I mean, this is...
Plaza's first role, I think, and, like... Yeah. Ellie Kemper, I think, is a Derek comedy member.
She's really great. She has
she has a great running gag.
She has a great running gag. She's a girl who
she's the fourth person in town who's on their wavelength.
Exactly. She's a girl from the who's constantly asking them to solve crimes. And that's the other thing too is that, you know, they describe the crimes.
Something's
that they
fishy
solve.
Over at the sardine factory. Exactly. I think it's fish.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, like they were like, you know, somebody stole a pie. Or a sack lunch dispute is listed as one of the crimes that they specialize in. So the idea is like, well, what if our parents were brutally murdered and we have to solve that crime? So the premise of the film is them kind of losing their innocence and gaining is kind of a new maturity and wisdom as they kind of are forced to leave this world of Eisenhower innocence. And kind of be part of this degraded kind of Cinemax R-rated world where people have sex and swear and there's some gross out gags in there that are actually pretty inspired.
Yeah. Which that takes a good deal of effort to actually not lean on it as laziness, like to actually do something with it.
Yeah. I mean, my God, yeah, there's some and it's a very, very quotable movie as well. Yeah, there's a line like where DC Britton's character has to like go into a toilet to retrieve something, and he's like, "Oh, I touched something hard that was inside something soft," and just for some reason, just the mental image of that is just like so gross and weird that like yeah, it stands out as more than just a funny line. And this is a very, very funny movie, but and it feels like it should be a Funny or Die sketch. You know, it feels like this should be 4.5 minutes, then it, you know, runs out. It's a relatively limited premise. But it doesn't. It's like a one-joke movie that is very, very funny for 95 minutes and works as a movie, not just as a very, very long sketch.
Right. And I think one thing that helps with that is that they actually took the time to give the characters character arcs. That it's not just, they're not just static characters. They don't, like, they have to grow and mature, like you said. Like, especially, you know, there's the second act falling out where it turns out that the other two boys, the non-Donald Glover boys, have actually applied for colleges. And that's something that never occurred to him because Donald Glover's, his character is sort of crystallized in this immaturity and he thought that would be the case forever. And the best part is that character is reflected in Bobby Moynihan's character, who's this, you know, guy who peaked in high school and is super proud of it. And he thinks that Donald Glover's on his wavelength and they have great scenes together. So it's great that these one-note shticks.
He's like the past.
Little me.
Yeah. Little me.
Always tossing him ice cream sandwiches.
Totally. And Donald Glover, again, it's a very broad performance, but there are some really, really nice moments to it. There's a really a strong sense of heartbreak and rejection when he finds out that the other guys are going to college, which again, to everybody else in the world, like, yeah, that's what happens if you have any kind of ambition. You're 18 years old and then you go away to college. But he's like, no, I thought we were going to do what we did when we were 10 years old for the rest of our lives and we were going to be happy doing it and doing it together. And finding out, like, no, even the most, you know, emotionally stunted man children eventually, you know, take baby steps to get out of, you know, where they were. So it's very, very funny, but also oddly poignant. And it works emotionally in a way we didn't necessarily anticipate from a movie with that kind of a broad, kind of sketchy sort of premise.
Yeah. And again, like all the scenes where their innocence butts up against like this hardened Brian De Palma, Michael Mann world is really great. Like when they go to the gentleman's club and it's during the day. So it's, you get that distinct feel of like a strip club during the day when it's just barely occupied and all the
gross
day shift strippers are there with C-section scars and all that stuff. So they're suddenly confronted with the sexuality they haven't had to deal with before.
Yeah, yeah. I think they were 25 when they wrote it and they started it. And even then, you're like, oh my goodness, these people are very, very talented and they're destined for big, big things.
Indeed. And I almost feel bad for the other two because, I mean, like, they are all three great, like you said, and they inhabit the roles well. But, like, it just feels so many times like, and maybe this is just confirmation bias, but Donald Glover just acting circles around them. But that's also because his character is such a ball of charisma. And the other two have to be relatively restrained by comparison.
Well, I feel like this is a movie where they do everything right. They do everything better than they absolutely had to. And that starts with making Donald Glover the star of the movie. It's definitely a team effort, but Donald Glover is a star and he's the star and he's definitely a star even at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Nathan, may your bindle be filled with treasures and your heart be light with song as we move on to lesser climes.
Oh, dear Lord.
All right, we're back with Lee Winnell chat with Control, Nathan, and Clint. Now, Nathan, what were our selections this time?
Oh, my God. For some reason, I have not seen the motion picture Saw. I think it's because I just don't go in for the whole torture porn thing. I know that's not a phrase that people like to use, and it's not fair, and it's pejorative. But that's just kind of not my cup of tea. I mean, I like horror movies. I really like horror movies. But I was thinking about this. When we're looking at Netflix, our conversation usually goes, she says, hey, I want to really watch a horror movie. And I'm like, I don't really watch a horror movie. Let's watch a comedy. And then we wind up watching a true crime documentary. I'm not really sure how that works necessarily. Or we end up watching like a TV show. I've been watching Vice Principals, which is really, really good. I'm thinking about doing for like a first TV lukewarm takes. So I don't end up seeing a lot of new horror movies. And watching Dead Silence, I realized why that's true. A lot of them are just fucking terrible. And when I say terrible, like I got nothing out of Dead Silence, which was the second option. It was the 2007 collaboration between James Saw, as I am now deliberately calling him, Lee Winnell, that did not go well. Hi-yo.
What?
Oh. Yeah. Well, if you enjoyed Billy the Billy the Puppet.
Billy the Puppet.
In Saw, which is like that ominous thing.
Do you want to play a game?
Yeah. Want to play a game? So they decided they had so much fun that they would just do kind of a ventriloquist dummy movie or an evil ventriloquist dummy.
Like you said, he's very doll heavy in like his horror inspirations. But this is the movie where he's like, yeah, but like the process behind doll interactions is also going to be the vehicle for horror here. We're not just going to do dolls, but ventriloquism.
Exactly, and a very specific, and one's a very specific kind of doll, and yet at the same time, kind of just a generic one size fits all. Because the thing about a ventriloquist dummy is it's only really distinctive if somebody is using it, as a ventriloquist. Otherwise, it's just a fucking doll that's built a little bit differently. So this, this fucking movie begins with a gentleman, James Ashen, that's his name there?
James Ashen.
Yeah, he's
played by Ryan Kwanten, one of the guys who kind of looks like he would be a Hollywood Chris.
Yes. I thought he looked like a less charismatic Lachlan Monroe. From Dead Man on Campus. So it starts off with a couple of receiving a package, a spooky package. Ooh. And this package contains Billy the Ventriloquist Dummy. not to be confused with Billy the Puppet. I said in my review, I imagine that with Annabelle, they wanted to call her Billy the Spooky Doll. They're like, it's a fucking
only so
girl.
Many names
you
for
can't call her Billy again. For fuck's sake,
there are
ladies
named Billy.
So what happens is, so they open the package and they're like, oh look, it's a spooky ventriloquist doll. That's a little bit weird. And then what happens is the wife is brutally murdered and her tongue is ripped out. Yeah, so James Ashen, basically his alibi is, hey, I didn't commit the horrible crime, even though I was the only person in the apartment at that time. What happened was this evil ventriloquist dummy must have come to life and brutally murdered her. So Mark Wahlberg
checks out,
who portrays
Donnie Wahlberg.
Oh, yeah, Donnie Wahlberg. That's true. The lesser Wahlberg. And again, I felt like watching this movie, I felt like I was watching Johnny Drama.
Well, I thought that I was watching Donnie Wahlberg's detective character from the two Saw films he was in.
Oh, because
he also played a detective in those.
Did how much time did he spend shaving?
Probably less so than.
What was his facial hair like?
He had a little goatee.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So
I feel like that maybe the shaving thing was the way he's like, okay, I'm playing a detective in this movie too. I'm gonna set him apart. He's gonna be shaving all the time.
I just felt like, and the thing is, like, that was so fucking annoying. He had multiple scenes. He whips out an electric razor, and even though he's in the company of other people, he decides to shave publicly. So he's like, you know, this story about the evil dummy coming to life and then brutally murdering your wife doesn't really check out, but you're free to go. And if you want to leave town, that's okay too. If you want to go back to your town to research the evil voodoo curse that led to this evil ventriloquist. Oh my God. All right, I'm getting angry. Please explain the rest of the plot while I seethe with rage here at my computer.
Oh, I couldn't even imagine doing that. Like, it's basically, it all sort of rests around this woman named Mary Shaw, who I guess
Have children?
She did have children, I think.
She did not have children.
Full disclosure. Oh,
good Lord. She had no children at all.
Full disclosure, I only rewatched clips of Dead Silence
because
I couldn't be cut dead.
No.
You can't control me, patrons.
Although, technically, the name of the feature does convey that they can control you.
Perhaps.
So you're saying they can't put their hand up your ass and
do
what they want?
I did watch this movie a decade ago. I'm nobody's puppet.
Yeah.
All I remember is that Mary Shaw just, I guess she didn't have children and she made dolls.
She just had dolls, yes.
To sort of replace the children. And then it's that classic sort of thing where, like, I guess she was publicly humiliated and by, like, her poor ventriloquism. So she takes revenge.
You know that story about being publicly. And there are two scenes that I will fucking remember. One of which is, you know, Donnie Wahlberg whipping out the electric razor, being like, don't mind me. Look how much character I have. You got nothing on me, Peter Falk.
This is business.
Exactly.
I'm doing business. Keeping my hands busy.
And maybe it's a dominance move as well. That he's saying,
yeah,
I have so
probably.
Much power over you that you can't fucking use a
razor. I have better
at all.
Things to do. Yeah, I'm a busy
exactly,
guy.
But I'm multitasking. I'm so bored talking to you that I can just fucking multitask. But yeah, there is a scene of subpar ventriloquism, being shamed by a child. She's performing her ventriloquist act. She's like, you're the dummy. No, you're the dummy. No, you're the dummy.
Spooky. Oh, boy.
And then a little boy's like, I can see your lips are moving. Why are your lips moving? And why do I have a Cockney accent? and then that boy's murdered. Spoiler!
Oh, blimey, governor!
But the thing that I love about this, so basically, you're not gonna fucking see this movie. We don't feel bad about spoiling this shit for you.
No.
So basically what happens is it's found out that Mary Shaw, the evil subpar ventriloquist, who was publicly shamed for her subpar ventriloquism, was, I think, brutally murdered or something. And she decided to get revenge on everybody by kind of doing a ventriloquism from beyond sort of thing, where like her evil spirit would occupy different people, including the trophy wife of Bob Gunton, character actor Bob Gunton, who plays Jamie Ashen's father. And it turns out that Bob Gunton is actually just a human ventriloquist.
Yeah, that twist is so dumb.
Yeah, but yes, and that Mary Shaw was occupying the body of his hot trophy wife.
Yeah.
And then she was using that to occupy a whole bunch of other dolls, and it's so...
So it's like a ghost
possession thing. And the thing that's interesting, as I was looking about Wikipedia, and they said that there was an alternate scene, an alternate ending, when they explain what happened, and they explain that, okay, Mary Shaw, you know, was occupying these different bodies, and she occupied the body of the wife of Bob Gunton. And then they're just, fuck it, nobody cares. This is a shitty movie. We might as well just, like, you know, cut our fucking losses. And instead of explaining what the fuck happened, just be like, well, it's a shitty ventriloquist movie. And yeah, she came back from the grave.
They just go for the gotcha.
Well, and they, yeah, and they, and it ends with, and it ends with a, and, you know, and like a dark, ominous ending. And a lot of times I'd be like, well, that's good on you. You know, you were uncompromising. You were like grim to the end. But I'm like, no. No, no, I don't care about any of these fucking characters.
Yeah.
I felt like...
Well, and the movie looks like dog shit. It's all, like,
gray.
It's boring.
And I felt like, you know, I was thinking about, like, for a movie like House of the Devil, I would say, man, nothing happens in it. It's amazing. It's a masterpiece. Yeah. And in this, I would say, man, nothing happens in it. It's fucking terrible.
Right.
It was boring as shit.
House of the Devil is a mood piece, and Dead Silence has no mood.
No, it has no atmosphere. It has no dread. You're not interested in the world that it's creating. It's just a generic horror movie world, a generic
The sound design is terrible.
Yeah, and I, on some level, I'm like, well, they're not killing a bunch of people. Like, that's kind of admirable on some level. But I wish that they were killing people. I wish that there was a body count. I mean, because there are different criteria for horror movies, and one of them is how inventive and clever and inspired and funny are the kills. And the other is like, not at all. A, there are almost none of them. You don't actually get to see anybody get killed. And B, the people who do get killed in really boring and interesting ways.
Yeah, like, their jaw gets sort of ripped out and... like, or ripped open, and their tongue is out, and yeah, it's in like really unconvincing late 2000s CG as well.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and I'm impressed that Lee Whannell could develop and evolve as a writer. Because this is just a fucking worthless script. I mean, as I said in my review, like, I almost never regret watching a movie or reading a book. Because I feel like even if I don't like them, I'm going to get something out of them. I'm going to get, like, it's going to add to my frame of reference. Or I'll get, there'll be one scene or one moment or one performance that, like, I really enjoy or maybe refer to or reference. This one, nothing.
Nothing.
I did not gain anything by it. It's funny. Actually, something that I feel kind of bad asking Clint to watch it again when it's completely worthless and he won't get anything out of it. So I'm kind of glad that you didn't. I'm kind of glad that we didn't have a guest for this one.
Yeah,
because it would suck to ask somebody who I respect and admire
spread the virus of Dead Silence.
I felt like I would have gotten as much out of it from reading the Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, pretty much.
Watching it did not add anything to my experience at all.
Right.
When we had Elliot Kalin on to talk about Tales from the Crypt, he talked about how, you know, he would like the show, but he noticed as a TV guy, as a writer, that it generally went on for 3 or 4 more minutes than it really had to. And I feel like this is very Tales from the Crypt, except that it goes on 85 minutes longer than it has to. Also, if it were Tales from the Crypt, it would have a sense of humor about itself.
Right. It's an accomplishment that a 90-minute movie is this tedious.
Oh, well, and that's about a fucking ventriloquist. Like, there's not a fucking joke in this entire thing. Like, there's no humor. There's no campy. I mean, so
now imagine this. Beware the stare of Jeff Dunham. Would that have worked better?
That is 10 times more terrifying. And the fact that they turned around and turned Annabelle into... $100 million, you know, hundreds of millions of dollar, like, pop culture phenomenon. They're talented people with weird obsessions with dolls. This is the one time where it didn't pay off in any conceivable way, you know, financially, creatively. It's just a fucking black hole of a movie. And I regret having watched it.
You know, good horror movies will sometimes skate by on having interesting rules for survival. And, like, the rule here is that don't scream and she can't kill you, which is a weird thing. I guess, like, I feel like that was all they could do to sort of tie in this cool title they came up with. With, like, okay, it's Dead Silence. Why do we call it Dead Silent? Oh, because you have to stay silent and you can't scream when you, otherwise she'll kill you. And I'm just sort of like, oh, this is really dumb.
Yeah, well, and the ventriloquist dummy itself, really boring. You know, I've got a Tales from the Crypt episode with Bobcat Goldthwait and Don Rickles. That's ventriloquist themed. That's fucking great and hilarious and 100% what I wanted this movie to be, and it 100% is not.
I will say there is a clown doll in the movie that is voiced by Fred Tatasciore, who's a very prolific voice actor. who did a lot of stuff for like Futurama and The Simpsons and that kind of stuff. So that was, it was nice to see him there, but alas, better luck next time.
Yeah.
Better agent. All right. I think that's about enough. Moving on. All right, now for another horror show. The last week has been a buzz with all kinds of TV and political news revolving 1991's favorite sitcom star, Roseanne Barr. Nathan, why don't you take us a little bit through the timeline of Roseanne Gate?
Well, basically, I wrote about John Ronson's book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, for the Literature Society, and that was a book that came out in 2015. That was only 3 years ago, but as I said in my piece, like, it's already feels like a period piece. It feels like a relic of like a more innocent era. It was a time before we even had the idea that Donald Trump could get elected president. It was before sort of the Weinstein effect and before sort of the great emotional reckoning. It's like we knew that the world was garbage, and particularly the online world was garbage, but it had not attained the horrific nature that it does now. So basically what he does is he looks in this book at people who have been publicly shamed for making mistakes, the kind of range from kind of minor transgressions. He talks a lot about Justine Sacco, who was the South African PR person who attained international infamy when she tweeted, admittedly, a bad joke about, oh, I'm going to Africa, I hope I don't get AIDS, ha ha, I'm white. And again, it was a bad joke and elegantly phrased by a PR person. It would be received differently if it was written by a comedian, you know, like that, that guy who proposed that, you know, straight white male is the new N-word. So basically, so by the time she landed in South Africa, her career had been destroyed. And there was this international fury against her, with the idea being like, oh, she's the daughter of a billionaire. And she made this incredibly offensive racist joke about how she doesn't care about, you know, children dying of AIDS in Africa. And that was a gross miscalculation or misstatement of what she had done, the intent, the meaning, the context, but it didn't really matter. You know, there was this anger. There was this, it took an almost kind of like a physical sort of presence. There was just hatred and rage and fury. And again, she didn't really do anything that wrong. She made a joke that landed very badly. There's another story in there about a woman who devoted her life to kind of working with, you know, sort of learning disabled and autistic adults. And, you know, she went on a field trip and she liked to take sort of goofy, irreverent photos. So one of them at the Arlington, it shows that I'm laughing while I'm talking about this, the Arlington Military Cemetery, as, you know, saying silence and respect. And it's her pretending to yell and like giving the middle finger. And again, it's a silly joke that she thought she was just like sharing with her friends who were on her Facebook page. And what happened was the veterans of our great country seized upon this and again decided that this horrible woman, who was representative of a generation that had no respect for veterans, for elders, for propriety, you know, was horrifically and intentionally disrespecting our dead, our military dead. And again, her life was pretty much destroyed by a joke that landed wrong. So this kind of brings us to the Roseanne Barr incident, where yeah. Roseanne also tweeted a joke that landed very, very wrong. She said that Valerie Jarrett, who is an African-American, who was, you know,
she was an Obama advisor.
Yeah, that she was... she represented
Muslim Brotherhood plus Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, that if they had a baby, it would be her. And originally she said, like, I made a horrible mistake. I apologize profusely, like, to Valerie Jarrett, to blah, 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 blah.
No, so at first she said she was just Ambien tweeting.
No, I thought, because at the timeline it is kind of complicated because she's making a lot of excuses. And her point of view and her story change pretty dramatically over the course of it. It seems like it, and again, it kind of echoes when Donald Trump got caught saying, grab him by the pussy, where at first it was so horrible and so obvious that he had done it. I mean, there was fucking tape. You know, you could go to the tape. There was forensic evidence. There was concrete, irrefutable evidence that he was on tape saying, grab him by the pussy. If you're a star, you can do whatever you want. There was concrete evidence that Roseanne Barr tweeted that an African-American woman, you know, looked like a monkey and was the product of, you know, a terrorist organization and a world in which, you know, apes look like apes and have assumed, you know, sort of the power of people. So she, I think, was fucking apologizing for her life. And I'd be like, okay, I really, really fucked up and this could sink everything and I could literally lose tens of millions of dollars over this tweet. So she was like, I apologize, I was wrong, you know, this was irresponsible. And then she almost immediately got fired. And she almost immediately got fired because this was not a standalone tweet. If you go back and look at her timeline, and I've been following her for a couple of years, partially out of morbid fascination. Like, I'm Facebook friends with her daughter, who's a really interesting person, a comedian, Jenny Pentland. And I fucking feel for her. Because it's very, I can vouch. We've actually, you know, there was at least one tweet where we commiserated about having crazy mothers, which is one of those amazing sort of social media kind of moments. And yeah, I'd been following her and she had just been saying crazy, hateful, incredibly Islamophobic things. I mean, there was a tweet where she says of another African-American advisor that she has giant monkey balls or giant ape balls. So there you have, again, you're being super fucking racist. You're comparing an African-American person to an ape. And you're throwing in transphobia in there as well. Pizzagate. Again, just a hatred of the Obamas and a hatred of Hillary Clinton and a hatred of, I guess, the Democratic establishment that kind of veers into craziness and hatred and conspiracy theories. So I was not at all surprised to see that she had tweeted something that was incredibly racist. But the thing before is, like, it didn't matter that she was tweeting these horrible racist things because she wasn't making anybody money. She had crazied herself out of the mainstream of American society. She was kind of this lunatic, you know, throwing feces from the,
She was washed up.
Totally. And it was only when she became a huge star. And that's fucking fascinating to me, that somebody can spend 20 years in the wilderness acting crazy, being belligerent, saying hateful things, and nobody fucking cares. Like, nobody even pays attention. Like, she wasn't a tabloid fixture because tabloids didn't give a fuck about her anymore. It was only when she took the thing that had absolute value. I mean, it reminds me a lot of, I think a lot about when Titanic was being made. Somebody was interviewing James Cameron and they said, you know, this is the most expensive movie ever made. You know, there are a lot of questions about it. Like, are you scared that if this movie is a flop, that, you know, you won't be able to make movies anymore? And he said, what the fuck are you talking about? This could be the biggest flop of all time. And tomorrow I could get $100 million for Terminator 3. And it was a bit of a cocky, obnoxious thing to say, but it was also true. Because he had this thing that people fucking love and that he could always make money and that he could always return to. And that was kind of true for Roseanne as well.
Yeah.
So the thing was, like, will Roseanne's self-preservation instinct, will that outweigh her self-destruction instinct and her instinct to say things for the sake of being provocative and for the sake of being angry and for the sake of getting attention? And what we discovered very quickly is...
the answer is no.
That her demons took over, you know, and that, and again, it would be one thing if it were like, oh my God, she actually said something racist and that's completely out of character for her. But she said something incredibly racist that's incredibly in character for her. And that's what was so damning. And that's what I think brought down this sort of instant fall.
Yeah, it's true. But at the same time, it's fascinating to think about ABC's reaction to this, considering when they signed her up, they knew who she was. And they knew that this was going to happen. Like, she'd already been tweeting some weird shit.
You know? Yeah. They said, let's get this bull. We can make a lot of money out of this bull spending an hour and a half in this china shop and not destroying anything. You know, that combination of the china shop and the bull, people really love it. We can make a lot of money off it.
Yeah.
It turned out to not end well.
Right. Well, and also the Roseanne reboot and other things like Last Man Standing getting rescued from cancellation, that kind of thing, is a very, it feels very much like the networks, especially in this Trump era, are trying to be like, okay, well, we need to put in programming that that caters to the forgotten part of America. I know.
To powerless people like Tim Allen and Roseanne Barr.
Exactly.
Who have hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. And so, but at the same time, but they like, they have this working class facade that like people in, you know, in middle America, it appeals to them.
Hey, Tim Allen sold cocaine to a lot of working people.
I know.
The forgotten
right?
man.
The forgotten Hollywood elites.
Exactly.
But, you know, there's, at the same time, like, that sort of ignores the idea. I loved the tweets that were happening after Roseanne got canceled, being like, hey, well, you know, if you're looking for, like, really good sitcom TV about working class families just trying to get by, try Netflix's remake of One Day at a Time or Bob's Burgers. Like, those are the shows you should be looking for. Instead of, I think the biggest deal with, like, you know, Roseanne being such a part of the Trump brand of this like new conservatism, at least like being a figure in this movement.
Well, and that kind of like weird populism, you know, the whole like Kanye, like, you know, the expendables of you know, sort of unhinged celebrities who are crazed narcissists, who are kind of deeply separated from the rest of the world and from reality. I would say that's something that unites Kanye Trump.
Right, but I think it's inherently
Kanye and Roseanne is, yeah, that they're distanced from the rest of the world, partially by their incredible fame and partially by their incredible narcissism.
Of course, I've been really fascinated by the online discourse about like the cancellation and the blowback from conservatives who think that A, that this is like an attack on free speech, and B, that that Democrats are saying just things that are just as bad. Why aren't their shows canceled? When A, this, which opens up a sea of false equivalencies about like, oh, Bill Maher called Donald Trump's mom an orangutan, and because that's a type of ape, it means the exact same thing, and he should be canceled too. So A, it does not work that way.
No.
And B, you know what? You can have Bill Maher. If you're looking for an excuse, like, I think it's very funny that that's who conservatives think liberals flock to.
Well, Bill Mitchell had a great thing where he said, noted more on Bill Mitchell of the right, who I just know for saying idiotic things on Twitter. And he recently just tweeted a photograph of Shrek wearing a Make America Great Again hat with the caption, this one's for my MAGA collection.
Oh,
and
no.
I just want to, you know, go to Etsy and make like 1,000 of those t-shirts. But he said, why are people complaining? The whole point of Planet of the Apes is that the apes were so intelligent.
Oh, fuck.
They were so well-spoken.
Pop culture. They were so articulate.
They were good at sports, but they were very good at talking,
but
you know. They
talked
such
like
a preachers,
deliberate,
you know?
Twisting and misreading
like, so Bill Mitchell, do you want me to say that your mother looks like a chimpanzee? Is that something that you would
he would say, I would take it as a compliment purely for the sake of the argument and context. But that's the thing, and then it leads us to things like Sam B. Like, there was an uproar over Sam B called using the C word to describe Ivanka Trump. And calling
feckless?
It the same thing. Yeah, feckless.
That's the F
word.
Yes. Come on.
That is the, oh, sorry. Yes, correct. But like that, I find it very interesting because I feel like if Roseanne hadn't gotten canceled that week, no one would have said shit about that word and about Sam B's use of it.
No, they wouldn't have cared at all. I mean, it would have been bold, you know? I think people would have been like, whoa, you know, that would have gotten a lot of viral.
Sure. Maybe,
but no, again, like, I think, you know, they were looking for a but on your side, you do blah, 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 blah.
Oh, absolutely. But they don't understand how that works. And it's like,
they think
it's about saying mean things, irrespective of like the cultural factors about like racism and prejudice and hate speech.
Kind of the discourse on social media fascinates me. I mean, the fact that Ivanka Trump took a photograph like gazing adoringly at her baby, and people are like, you bitch, how dare you fucking run that provocative photograph when, you know, your daddy is fucking tearing babies away from their parents and separating families and doing all of these horrible things. And on one hand, I'm like, well, I agree. Your father is doing a lot of horrible things and you're a major advisor. On the other hand, it's kind of fucked up when people are being shamed for releasing photographs of themselves looking adoringly at their baby.
I think if she wasn't a part of the administration, I would agree with you.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah, yeah.
She has a seat at the table. So like,
oh, totally. I mean she's accountable, but I feel like if we're like, when we see red, any woman looking at her baby, like, with love and adoration in her eyes. And true, I mean, the fact that it was captioned, "I love my little white baby." Was, I think, a little bit provocative. Like, that might have been reasons why people were upset about it. But again, it's weird that we've gotten to a place in the world where you can be shamed for, you know, posting yourself smiling at your baby.
It's true. At the same time, I think that conservatives have a both figurative and probably quite literal boner for Ivanka in, like, a very disturbing way. Like, they all flock around her.
She's a very attractive woman.
She is a very attractive woman, but
being a lot, like, both extremely, extremely attractive.
There's this pathological characterization of Ivanka as, like, this beautiful, immaculate princess.
Aryan princess.
Aryan princess who, like, can do no wrong and should be protected. Like, every conservative treats it like someone, like, it's like she's their daughter. Like, and they're everyone's overprotective dads. Like, even, like, Rudy Giuliani, like, in that Hannity interview, talking about how, like, oh, no, but, you know, Ivanka's beautiful. You shouldn't say anything like that about her. Like, oh, what about Jared? Oh, well, you know, men are men are disposable. that kind of thing. So, like, I think it's to Ivanka specifically that makes me feel a little weird.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And it's funny, I also wrote about Ben Garrison, who's a sort of crazy alt-right political cartoonist who does things that are kind of beyond parody. And one of his most notorious and infamous cartoons was one of contrasting Michelle Obama and Melania Trump. And in it, Michelle Obama has a penis, has, like, a bulge, and her crotch is looking, like, very angry and, like, very muscular. The idea being, like, oh, she's like a man. She's like a linebacker. And Melania Trump is the sort of delicate flower of white femininity. And it says, make the first lady great again. It's like, you know, Michelle Obama, again, I feel like the only way you can hate Michelle Obama is if you're racist as fuck and you're doing it for divisive reasons, because she's, like, an incredibly, you know, elegant, dignified woman who is...
I don't like her telling my kids what to eat.
Exactly. She hasn't done anything wrong. And this idea that, like, Melania Trump is, you know, this figure.
Yeah,
like,
Jackie figure.
It's perplexing.
By the way, where's Melania? In the world is Melania
where
Trump?
Where in the world is Melania? But again, I think, like, you know, there's a sense of, you know, that the flower of wet womanhood must be defended at all costs. You know, whereas if you're going to compare the Obamas to monkeys, it's like, yeah, whatever. It's comedy. You can't, and that's the other thing too, is it's like her whole, like, man, I can understand why people are offended by this. It's like, motherfucker, we've did 8 years of racist caricatures of the Obamas as monkeys. That's a big part of the reason why the response to this was, fuck you, you racist asshole.
Right, on top of these centuries of calling black people apes.
Oh, very much so. The context was very, very, very apparent, and it wasn't in your favor. And you know, she was trying to back up, like, oh, I thought she was, like, Persian, or, like, you know. No. But, again, there's, you know, the parallel, like, when Trump, like, hey, I got caught red-handed, I'm sorry. And that I'm sorry was immediately followed by, I'm sorry that Bill Clinton's 10 times worse and he's even more disgusting. And she did the same thing where she's like, you know, it's like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that nobody can take a joke and I wasn't being racist and everybody misjudged me and I'm on Ambien. And I thought she was Persian and Iranian. It's like, no, please.
No, none of that. No. Just stop equivocating. Like, it's so just own it.
So what do you see next, both for the show and for Roseanne?
Well, apparently ABC is in talks to disappointingly backpedal and find a way to retool the show just focusing on Sarah Gilbert's character. That's what we're hearing along the TV grapevine. So it's entirely possible that it may come back. So to a certain extent, it's like, oh, well, I mean, at least the people who, like, had jobs, who, like, Roseanne inadvertently employed or, like, you know, in some way employed, will still be able to work. At the same time, they knew what they signed up for.
That is true.
And it just feels like backpedaling otherwise very, like, strong decision by ABC. I don't know. So we'll see what happens. I'm convinced that people will forget about this in a week.
Do you think so?
Because I think that's the way the world works now. I mean, like, while I was just listening to Pod Save America earlier today, and like the day that the cancellation news dropped, all the news networks spent like a collective 10 hours talking about it, and only 30 minutes on like the study that came out that said 5,000 people in Puerto Rico had died because of the Trump administration's lack of action after like after the hurricanes and everything. So it's like it's just a matter of like choosing priorities and what's shiny. And I think there's going to be a new thing. And even today, even this morning, as we record this, Trump literally tweeted about how he has the ability to pardon himself, but he won't pardon himself because he's innocent. So of course he naturally thought about that. Like, of course he naturally looked up that option for pardoning himself for the thing he didn't do. And it's just, it's like 10 new crises every single day. And I think that's why people are demoralized and angry. And of course, people are lashing out at social media. I think a lot of times rightfully so. And when taking a step back, it can seem like a little ridiculous, especially with the public shaming and the call out culture and stuff. But I think there's like just to a certain extent, a kind of a reckoning. And I think we need to be able to find ways to not be defensive about being called out in that way and sort of being self-reflective instead of doubling down and making excuses.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like this was a teachable moment and Roseanne Barr refused to be taught.
Yeah, or she learned the wrong lesson.
Exactly. You know, she learned the lesson that, you know, it's unfair out there for white Republicans.
Yeah, indeed. They are truly an oppressed class.
Nobody has it worse than them.
Despite having the presidency and both houses.
Nobody has it worse than them, except for literally every other group.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's move on. And it's time for the mailbag. We do have a mailbag, do we not?
Yay.
Yes, this one is from Andrew Zimmerman. And it was a rather long one, but I'll talk about the part that's just like the question, because I know he requested a 4.0 from you. So you already did that. So it's fine. Thank you, Andrew. Longtime admirer of your stuff.
Which 4.0 is it?
I'll have to look up the email again. But it was like you had replied back to him about things. But anyway, longtime admirer of your stuff, I thought I'd take the opportunity to reach out. I believe that reading your work has made me, STEM major and no great expert on the subject of film, think in more critical terms about things I watch, which I think is a trait of great criticism and something I could only honestly say of a few other critics. Anyway, I've been digging the podcast and it's inspired me to add Clint's podcast to my regular listening as well. Well, thank you, Andrew. I really appreciate that. My mailbag question is, what would you say was your biggest surprise upon relocating to the American South? Any preconceptions that were challenged or debunked altogether? I am myself a Colorado native and recent transplant to the city of Savannah, which I've actually found to be quite a charming town. Thanks for your question, Andrew, and thank you for following my podcast, whichever one of the other million ones I do now. Nathan, what do you say to that?
That is a good question, definitely. I think it probably what surprised me the most about moving down to Atlanta was how little I missed Chicago. I mean, I got my grad for decades upon decades. Being a Chicagoan was like very, very central to my identity. I thought I would live there forever. I bought a condo there, you know, with a 30-year mortgage, imagining that, you know, I would live there every last day of that mortgage. But what I discovered was I really don't miss it. I mean, there are elements of it that I miss. I miss when I'm sitting out with Clint. I miss the Lawrence Fish Market. I miss Lou Malnati's. But yeah, I guess it's just, it's weirdly, yeah, I guess the homesickness hasn't been anywhere near as bad as I had anticipated. And I think I'm happier than I imagined. I think I'm more comfortable here than I had anticipated. Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of a bit of a laid-back fellow in a lot of ways. So this kind of suits me.
So is it the slower pace?
I think so. I like the slower pace. I like that it's not as crowded. It's like sort of like when you ride the MARTA, for example. There are very few people on it because nobody actually, it's not that great to be brutally honest, but there are never more than like five people on a train and they generally do not look like, do not have grim expressions. They don't look like they're dead on the inside, which I feel like is the default mode of the Chicago commuter, is to look like you shut everything down.
I have that look on my face right now.
Exactly. You know, and that look of please don't talk to me. You know, it's like I'm listening to my fucking podcast. Like, don't talk to me. I'm just my ride is next. Like, there's sort of just a toughness that you kind of have living in a big city, living in kind of an expensive city with a lot of problems. So yeah, I think there's just kind of an ease to life in the South. Sort of unsteadied pace that I really, really enjoy, and that yeah, I would not move back to Chicago unless you paid me an enormous amount of money to do so at this point.
Has your consumption of sweet tea and mint juleps increased since moving to the South?
I do it at Waffle House lot more. I love the food. That's another great part. I mean, the food in Chicago is really amazing. But the food in Atlanta is really amazing as well. And I just, I'm an appreciative motherfucker. I like that they're such a good Taco Bell KFC. only about 8 blocks away from where I am. I like that, you know, there's a diner that has like wood paneling that hasn't like changed since 1983. Like, yeah, I find ways to make places my own. And I'm doing that right now with Shambly Tucker.
Nice. All right. Well, Andrew, thanks so much for your question. If you want to, be like Andrew and ask us a question, we would love to read it on the show and answer it. You can email us at asknathanrabinshappycast@gmail.com. And before we go, I actually want to point out, Andrew, thank you so much for talking about the ways criticism has, sort of increased or changed your understanding of film and you know, thinking in more critical terms about things, because that's like a goal that I think a lot of film critics have, including myself. So it's nice to hear when that works. So I really, really appreciate it. All right, moving on. And we'll finish up with happy places. Nathan, what's your happy place this week?
Sure. Well, my happy place this week is the North DeKalb Mall, which is where I saw Upgrade at sort of my theater that I go to most often. It's $4.80, and I went there for the first time since I moved to Shambly Tucker, and it was about a $10 lift ride, but I just fucking love the place. There's something about a sad old mall where about 70% of the stores are shut down, and the only ones that are like weird fucking places, you know.
How Dawn of the Dead is it?
It's very Dawn of the Dead. But like a very interesting, right? Like there are a bunch of bodegas inside it, which don't really make sense. And they're like bodegas that sell like pipes and shit.
Nice. Yeah. Are there cats in the bodegas?
There are not cats in the bodegas, damn, unfortunately. And there's like that one movie theater. So yeah, I love you, North DeKalb Mall. You are the best place to see a movie.
Excellent. My happy place is a weird one. It's the gym, because I finally went to the gym for the first time in months last week. And literally, no lie, today is the first day that my legs haven't burned. Because I decided to go from zero to spin class. I took a spin class, Nathan. I'm officially one of those people now.
Oh my
and,
God.
It was rough. Because, I mean, I've never been to a spin class before. So, like, one of the things you notice is I didn't know you had to sign up. And you had to sign up an hour before the class started. But they were fine. They were forgiving of it. And, the bikes are different. And, like, you actually have to put earbuds in your ears because the music is so loud. And then there's like an instructor there with a microphone, like with a headset, but like with the earbuds and the music, all I could hear was like Charlie Brown's teacher. So I didn't really know what was going on. I was just watching everyone else. And I think I was one of two guys in the class and like only one of three people who weren't like rail thin yoga moms. Not that they weren't nice, which they were. They were all nice and accommodating. One of the things about spin class is like, you know, there are times when you're sitting on the bike, and then there are times when you have to stand and pedal while you're standing because that'll work out your quads. I could only do that for about 10 minutes, and then like I just pedaled through the rest of it, like sitting down. And ever since then, like I have, my legs have burned and I have had trouble getting up and down stairs. But basically the thing now is, now the genie's out of the bottle. So now I have to go back, because if I don't, in 6 weeks, if I go back, the exact same thing's going to happen and I'm going to be out of commission for a week. But I'm sort of grateful that I went and I sort of ripped the Band-Aid off, so to speak. And now that my legs are done being miserable, next time I go, it'll be easier and I will hopefully lose some weight for this damn wedding I'm in.
Would you say that you're blasting your quads?
I am blasting my quads. funny enough, I was looking up, like, why do my legs? Because my legs didn't hurt the day of going to the gym. But then, like, the next two, three days, they were just burning. And I looked it up, and I was like, what is this? And it's something called delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS. So for the past week, I've just been pounded by DOMS mercilessly. But so I'm hoping to, like, you know, I'm just hoping to be a little more active and not be as much of a fat ass as I've been. So that's my happy place.
I think you look great.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I think you're an Adonis.
Oh, well, thank you. Look at my rippling abs and my chest V. My V? I forget what they call them. I think the Flophouse calls them Thunderers. Yeah. But I think that's hashtag goals. All right.
And hashtag blessed. And then I'm blessed to have them naturally.
Quite. great cheese on those motherfuckers.
That wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Rabin's HappyCast. You can find me on Twitter at @AlcoHollywood and Nathan at Nathan Rabin. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and pledge to our Patreon at patreon.com/NathanRabin's HappyCast. Our theme song is by John Beacon. Check out his stuff at johnbeacon.com. Until next time, I bid you a hearty whoop whoop.